come up on a tight wire.
I'm sitting here in Studio B, sitting across from my good friend, Daniel Chacon.
And I'm across from my good friend, Benjamin Alira Sines.
And welcome to the third season of Words on a Wire.
At a new time. We're at noon, if you haven't noticed. And if you tuned in at 11:30 and heard some Latinos speaking, that wasn't us. But we are Latinos speaking.
But we are Latinos.
We're very glad to be back. Today we have on our show J.L. Powers, novelist and editor. And she's going to talk about her new books.
And for this week's Poetic License, we have Lisa Garibay, who works for UTEP's University Communications.
And she's going to talk a little bit about going off to college for the first time in the East Coast.
And our Poem of the Week comes to us from Naomi Nye.
And Ben's going to read it. It's going to be a great show. So, Ben, it's good to be back in the studio after, what has it been, 4 months?
4 months.
That was a long summer. What did you do?
Well, I stuck around home, took care of Buddy, and
your dog, Buddy, the cutest dog in the world,
dog,
next to Kafka,
who you are training, and I worked on my new young adult novel.
Awesome, awesome.
And what did you do?
I traveled a lot. I went to China. I went to Spain. And then I spent most of the summer on Venice Beach, about a block away from the beach and all the weird people and the medical marijuana salespeople.
Well, it sounds like you had a lot more fun than I did. And then how was Spain?
Spain was good. I kind of understood the language there, although Spaniards talk a little funny. They speak as if they're just learning the language. But other than that...
What's that song? Well, I never been to Spain.
Spain was good. I went with my brother. It was a fantastic summer. I got a lot of writing done, a lot of reading.
And during the summer, you got some really great reviews for Hotel Juarez.
I sure did. I don't know where they came from, but yeah, there were some really good reviews. So
we're very proud of you.
Well, you know what? It's not the Penn Faulkner, but I'm waiting in line for the next one, Ben.
Well, Daniel, it's good to be back in the studio with you.
It's good to be back in El Paso. I really missed it. As much as I love the beach and all those other places that I've been to, El Paso is home.
Well, listeners, welcome to the third year of Words on a Wire. Stay tuned and stay happy. This week's guest on Words on a Wire is J.L. Powers, though I must confess I have a difficult time calling her J.L. since she's a former student and I knew her as Jessie. So I'll just continue my introduction with that disclaimer. J.L. Powers explores social issues involving violence, sexuality, and race in her books for young adults. She is the author of The Confessional, a novel for young adults that explores racial tension and violence on the U.S.-Mexico border. In a starred review, Publishers Weekly said, Powers' first novel powerfully combines timely storylines regarding illegal immigration, school violence, and racial tension. While the Bulletin of the Center for Children's Books declared that Powers confronts issues of anti-immigrant prejudice and anti-terrorist hysteria, with brutal honesty describing a world not often depicted in literature for young people. Jessie, welcome to Words on a Wire.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
I want to ask you one question to begin with. You're in our MFA program how many years ago here at the University of Texas at El Paso?
Oh, it's embarrassing to admit how many years ago, but I graduated in 1999.
And your thesis was as a poet, is that correct?
It was partly with poetry and partly short stories, so I did half and half.
And then after you got your MFA, you decided to go into the intellectual field, and you went to Stanford to be an Africanist, is that correct?
That's correct.
And what drew you to being an Africanist?
Well, the last summer that I was at UTEP, I took a class in the summer. Well, I was teaching in the summer, and when you're a graduate student, at least back then, if you were teaching a class, you had to take a class. So I saw that they were offering an African history class, and I took it. And I was so intellectually stimulated by the process. And I think, you know, I was 24 when I took that class, and I realized I was going to be graduating in a year, And I felt like I had gained a lot of skills in terms of writing, but I had no knowledge about anything. I felt really clueless about the world. And I thought, I don't have anything to write about. I haven't experienced a whole lot. So I was so intellectually stimulated by it, I felt very challenged by the subject matter, that I thought, you know, I need to spend some time learning about something, not just learning the skill of writing, but learning about something. But beyond that, you know, I think growing up in El Paso, I grew up, you know, I'm not Latino or Latina, but I grew up in El Paso, and I just have always felt very drawn to other cultures as a result, growing up essentially as a minority, which is very unusual for, a white girl to grow up as a minority in the United States, but I did. And I think I was really drawn to, you know, the states in Africa that had been settled by colonizers, and I was drawn to the racial tensions and the cross-cultural implications of, you know, Europeans migrating there, and these subjects, I think, were very much things I wanted to explore because of growing up in El Paso. And so there were just really a myriad of reasons why I ended up studying African history, but I think the first and most important one was that I felt like I didn't know anything about the world.
Well, which is interesting, because being an Africanist led you to eventually write this novel called This Thing Called the Future.
Yes.
And did you actually visit South Africa?
Oh, yes. You know, I took intensive Zulu for 3 years, and 10 weeks of that intensive Zulu was in South Africa, during which time I lived with a Zulu family in a township called Mbali, which is the township that's in my book. And I was taking, you know, 5 hours of Zulu every day, and then living with a Zulu family. And then I returned. I became fascinated with the concept of healing in South Africa, or actually in Africa. You know, Africans are obsessed with healing. And I don't know if I think that's partly because there's more disease in Africa than there is in many other parts of the world. I mean, you know, mankind evolved there, and so did the diseases that come along with mankind. And so there's all of these diseases, and Africans are obsessed with healing. And also in South Africa in particular, because of the apartheid state and the wounds that have been left on society because of the terrible racism and legalized racism that was enshrined through apartheid and glorified in the religion, the Christian religion that was taught there in the Reformed Church, people are also obsessed with this idea of healing social wounds. And so these all come together in this glorious smattering of healers everywhere you look. Like, you can't walk down a city street, literally, in South Africa without tripping over a healer of some type. And people stand on street corners and they hand out these pamphlets to you that promise, you know, if you go to this, you know, Mama Abu or whatever, who's just around the corner, you can be healed from these things. And so here I was, immersed in this society, learning Zulu, living with a Zulu family, and really, really interested in this question of healing, and that led to this novel. And I might add that, you know, at the time that I was there, HIV was the height of the epidemic, was, you know, reaching its apex in, you know, 2006, 2007, and 2008. And so every time I returned to do more research for the book, you know, I was also focusing on this question of how HIV was devastating the communities and how people were responding to that.
And was it heartbreaking for you to write this novel?
It was. You know, I had three Zulu sisters in the family that I lived in. They were 6 years old, 13 and 14. And, you know, the 13 and 14-year-old used to come to my bedroom at night, every night, and sit on my bed. It was very cold in that house, so I'd be huddled under blankets with a hot water bottle. People don't think of Africa as being cold, but it was really cold. And they would sit there and they would tell me their secrets about their lives. And one night, the 13-year-old told me that she wasn't allowed to go to church anymore by herself. And I said, why not? And she said, because Gogo, the grandmother, caught me kissing my boyfriend. And I was like, oh, you have a boyfriend. And I thought she was going to tell me this sweet little story about, you know, a fellow 13-year-old in her class. But it turned out that her boyfriend was a taxi driver in the townships. He was in his 30s. And I just sat back in shock and tried to figure out how do I respond to this in this exact moment, and realizing that my 13-year-old sister is clearly at risk for getting HIV. And so it was a very direct and very personal story. The statistics are heartbreaking, but, you know, I had actual people that I loved that were at risk.
And how difficult was it to get into your character Cosi's head?
You know, the novel took me close to 3 years to write, and I think it's because it was difficult to get into her head. The first few drafts were, you know, very brief, and I had planned, oh, I'm just going to write, it's going to be like an 80-page novel, you know, with really short chapters. And really short chapters because that felt safer to me. Like, you know, you can get in and get out, and you can't make too many mistakes if you just get in into her head and get out. Pull out really quick. And as it evolved, that could no longer be it couldn't be a safe novel anymore. And writers can't write safe novels. If we write safe novels, then what are we doing?
That's exactly right.
We're talking to J.L. Powers, author of This Thing Called the Future, and a new novel called Amina, which also takes place in Africa. I wanted to ask you a question about, you said you studied Zulu for 5 hours a day. That is quite a commitment. And I imagine it must have given you some sort of linguistic insight into the culture that you would not have had hadn't you been so committed. Can you give us some examples of that?
Well, you know, there are, of course, all sorts of sayings in Zulu that, you know, are partly a result of the evolution of the culture, that are very hard, actually, to understand until you've been studying the language for a long time. There's funny ones, like, you know, it's so hot, the fish are hopping out of the water. and then there's these ones that, you know, you wonder, what does this mean? And, like, for example, no spirit fails to go home. What does that mean? And what does that means something really different to me.
Right. Can you say that in Zulu?
Not at the moment.
Sorry, I hate to put you on the spot. Okay.
Jessica, let me ask you something. Since you know a little bit of Zulu, do you ever look around town for a Zulu restaurant so you can impress people and order in the actual language?
There is no such thing as a Zulu restaurant anywhere in the United States.
Oh, that's right. All right. Let me ask you another question. I'm going to back off from all the seriousness. When you were a student here at UTEP, I always called you Jessie, and most people called you Jessica. So why did you choose your nom de plume to be J.L. Powers?
Well, you know, my first novel was The Confessional. It was set in El Paso, and it was about young men. All the protagonists were young men, and they were—
Who went to Cathedral High School?
Yes, although I named it Jesuit High.
Right.
You know, I was being political, but— when my editor, I was just planning to be, you know, Jessica Powers, but my editor approached me and said, you know, we want young men to buy this novel, and we don't think they'll buy it if you write with Jessica.
Oh, that's interesting.
So they called you J.L. Powers.
Yes. So they suggested that I find a different choice.
Well, it is a very strong name, J.L. Powers.
And you were comfortable with that? Like, it's okay?
Well, you know, I was probably more comfortable with it than if the idea had come out of nowhere. But, you know, I grew up reading these 19th century authors who all had initials for their first names or wrote under initials.
Right.
And, you know, one of my all-time favorite children's authors is L.M. Montgomery, who wrote the Anne of Green Gables series. And so as a kid, knowing I wanted to be a writer when I grew up, and I loved L.M. Montgomery, I used to kind of play around with this. Should I be J.L. Powers? And so it was less of a shock than it might have been for other people. But you know what is weird is when people call me J.L., because I certainly don't think of myself as J.L.
I certainly don't think of you that way.
It makes you sound like an executive, J.L.
So did you get any flack for writing this book as a white woman, writing about a Zulu adolescent?
Well, the answer is yes and no. So I should say that I got some flack for my first book, too, because I wrote from boys' perspective.
Right.
And maybe less flack than I would have otherwise, because I grew up in El Paso. There, you know, there are some Latino characters in there as well. But, you know, I did it with my first book, too. And so I'd already sort of steeled myself to the inevitable possibility of people questioning me. about it. You know, most people have really embraced the book. It certainly, you know, won a lot of awards. I did have one friend from Zimbabwe who, you know, wasn't sure. We talked about it a long time. She speaks Ndebele, which is very close to Zulu, and so she had been one of my practice partners for a long time at Stanford. And we talked about it a lot, and, you know, she came away deciding that it was okay, and she read a novel written by a black Zimbabwean that she read, and she was like, man, that is not the Zimbabwe I know at all. And so she said maybe it's not a perspective of who writes the book so much all the time. I did have one incident where a couple of African-American authors were sort of visibly rude to me on a panel, and, you know, later some audience members, you know, it filtered back to me that they had noticed that it was, you know, that it was visible. And I knew, you know, one of those authors is, you know, is very sort of adamant that whites shouldn't write about black characters. So I have had some flack. But ultimately, you know, I feel like if we can't write about, you know, am I only allowed to write about white girls who grow up in a Latino community? Because that's my experience.
Right.
Is that all I'm allowed to write? You know, I would have loved to say to one of these African-American authors who write about, one of them writes about some, you know, disabled characters, and she's not disabled. Well, I spent several years with debilitating pain, went to the Mayo Clinic. I was disabled for a couple of years. I know what it's like. And, you know, I wonder, you know, she's also writing about people that are different from herself. We all do it.
Exactly.
The question is, where do you draw the line? And everybody has different opinions about that.
Right. You're not only an author, you're also an editor. And you edited through Cinco Puntos Press That Mad Game, Growing Up in a War Zone, an anthology of essays from around the globe. Can you talk a little bit about that experience and how you came up with that idea?
Yeah, well, Bobby Bird at Cinco Puntos one time asked me to read a book set, it was a novel set in Ireland during some of the Troubles, and they were thinking about publishing it. And so I read it, and not entirely sure who had the idea first, but either Bobby or I made the comment, and this was many years ago, you know, there should be an anthology about this. And I kept returning to the idea because violence is one of the core things that I explore in all of my novels. In The Confessional, there is a murder, a kidnapping, a race riot. In this thing called The Future, my main character, Kosi, is stalked by a man with shape-shifting powers who wants to rape her, and it, you know, this is one of the most common things in South Africa. Young women's first sexual experiences is often very violent, and through rape, one in four men in South Africa have admitted to raping a young woman. And in Amina as well, of course, you know, I'm investigating the violence that she endures as a young woman growing up in a war-torn city. Violence is something that I am obsessed about, too, along with healing. You know, the two are probably related.
Right, they are, right? After violence, you need healing.
Probably in quotation marks.
Well, thank you so much, Jessica, for joining us. We're talking to J.L. Powers, author of This Thing Called the Future and editor of That Mad Game. Check out her webpage. She has a lot of other books that are just incredibly powerful. So thank you for joining us.
Jesse, thank you for being on Words on a Wire.
Thank you so much.
This week's Poem of the Week comes to us from Naomi Shaib Nye. The name of the poem, Arabic. The man with laughing eyes stops smiling to say, until you speak Arabic, you will not understand pain. Something to do with the back of the head. An Arab carries sorrow in the back of the head. That only language cracks. The thrum of stones, weeping, grating hinge on an old metal gate. Once you know, he whispered, you can enter the room whenever you need to. Music you heard from a distance, the slapped drum of a stranger's wedding, well up inside your skin, inside rain, 1,000 pulsing tongues, you are changed. Outside, the snow has finally stopped in a land where snow rarely falls. We had felt our days grow white and still. I thought pain had no tongue, or every tongue at once, supreme translator, sieve. I admit my shame, to live on the brink of Arabic, tugging its rich threads without understanding how to weave the rug. I have no gift, the sound but not the sense. I kept looking over his shoulder for someone else to talk to, recalling my dying friend, who only scrawled, "I can't write." What good would any grammar have been to her then? I touched his arm, held it hard, which sometimes you don't do in the Middle East, and said, "I'll work on it," feeling sad for his good, strict heart. But later, in the slick street, hailed a taxi by shouting, "Pain," and it stopped in every language and opened its doors. That poem came to us by the poet Naomi Shaib Nye.
We are happy to have in our studio today Lisa Garibay, who works here at the university at University Communications, but has been a writer all her life. So when I put out a call for poetic license, immediately she got back to me and said she had something she wanted to share. She is an award-winning journalist and is currently working on a memoir. Growing up here in El Paso, we're very happy to have you here with us, Lisa. So let's go ahead and listen to your poetic license.
Okay. So this piece came about last summer. I was witnessing a lot of kids getting on the road to college. This was probably around August of last year. And the buzz was happening of, you know, kids packing up and getting ready to make this big adventure of going off to college. I was also working at the airport at the time. And so I saw this constant traffic of kids and their parents who were coming through the airport and getting ready to depart on this next big important phase of their lives. And it made me think of myself doing the exact same thing close to 20 years previous. And so this piece came out. It is something that I do intend to put into my memoir, which will probably be a collection of shorter pieces rather than something very lengthy. And so once again, we are here a year later when college is starting back up, and I walk around campus and see all these wide-eyed, fresh faces, and I think again about what it was like for me to go very far from home for the very first time as a very young person. And so here's the piece, and it's entitled, "I'm Supposed to Shower with Strange Boys." Arrival at college. Thousands of miles from home. Hot as hell, but not hot as home, just more humid. It's so green, and everyone is so pretty. They have expensive cars. There is no elevator up to my third floor dorm room. "Where are you from? What did you get on your SATs?" Questions like this prepare you for polite adult conversation that will be how you categorize every new person you meet, roughly from the age of 21 to 61, when you ask them, "And what do you do?" On this day in August, years before I am supposed to become an adult, I move impossibly heavy suitcases up three flights of stairs in an old, quote, historic brick building with no air conditioning. My mother and grandmother have come with me to settle me in at school. None of us knew what we were getting into. They left this college thing up to me. I got to pick where I wanted to go. I focused on the school that was furthest from home and that gave me the most financial aid. I had never been close to that part of the country before. "Where did you go to high school?" Nobody has heard of my all-girls Catholic academy in West Texas. My roommate smokes cigarettes, even though we both checked the non-smoking box on our rooming forms. That which our parents know about us is quickly being eclipsed by what we do that is contrary to their wishes. We are ecstatic at being on our own. I do, however, cry when my caretakers leave the next day. I have just turned 17. I have never had sex. I have never had a boyfriend. I remember kissing my best friend Jason, lips closed, 1 second, on the playground in first grade. The rest of my experience is what I've read in books. Reading books got me this far, the number one liberal arts college in the country, a baby ivy, cream of the crop. Nerdiness can get you anywhere, that is, except to prom with a proper date. Who cares? The past is past. This is my new life. I can be anyone I want. I am living in a co-ed dormitory. Rooms of boys next to a room of girls. Everyone sharing the bathroom. A couple of shower stalls, a few toilet stalls, a few sinks. I am supposed to shower with strange boys, brush my teeth next to them, have bowel movements and shave my legs and whatever else with just a plastic divider between one and another. What was more real, where I came from or where I am now? The nuns who ran my high school would have had a fit. My grandmother and mother don't say anything, although I am certain this is the topic of conversation on their entire multi-plane ride home. And now I'm on my own to figure these things out.
That was Lisa Garibay.
That was lovely.
Thank you. Did you really have to have bowel movements next to boys?
Well,
that is so weird.
You have to have them.
Did you really have to shower next to boys?
Yes. Yeah, absolutely had to shower next to boys. Indeed.
Well, we're happy you came back to El Paso.
I am very happy to be here, and I'm so thrilled that you guys invited me onto the show.
All right, well, thank you. Lisa Garibay. We'd like to thank our guests, J.L. Powers, a.k.a. Jesse, and Lisa Garibay and her poetic license. And Ben, thank you for reading that lovely poem.
By Naomi Nye.
If you are interested in doing a poetic license, please contact me, Dan Chacon at utep.edu. And also remember that all of our shows are podcasts, except for, you know what? We're missing one show. You can get to all our shows, but there's one show that's missing.
What show is that?
The one with Rigoberto Gonzalez.
Why?
I don't know. Maybe somebody stole it. It's just not there.
Oh, my God.
It's very strange. But all the other shows, everything from Mark Strand to J.L. Powers, is all podcasts. Go to imaginarywater.com, hit radio, and it'll have a list of all the people that have been on the show.
I know who stole Rigoberto's show.
Who was it? Was it Rich Yanez? I knew it.
No. It's the guy who steals my socks when I do the laundry.
Buddy, it's your dog.
No, it's not.
Yeah,
it's
Buddy
not.
Steals your socks.
There's
I know, he ate my sandals.
One-legged man who steals my socks when I do the laundry.
You know, I'm staying with Ben right now until I get my new place because I've been out of town for a little while. And his dog is the cutest dog in the world next to Kafka. Cutest dog in the world, but he chews everything. He chews my books.
What's because he thinks he's a goat?
He chews my sandals. And I think he chews your other sock.
Absolutely.
And Rigoberto Gonzalez's episode of Words on a Wire.
Thank you for listening to another edition of Words on a Wire.
I'm Daniel Chacon.
And I'm Ben Hamin Alida Sainz.
And don't forget, the next book you read
may save your life.
I'm up on a tight wire. One side's ice and one is fire. It's a circle.